Hey there, I'm Jason Gotts, and you're listening to Think Again, a Big Think podcast. A grow light for humans that cooks a guy's face. A pharmaceutical mist that puts you in the right mood for mourning the victims of terrorism. The year of all hell breaks loose. The year of the censor. Mudslides. Hurricanes. People who flee and people who stubbornly stay put. A terrible structure. A grand experiment. Creams and lotions that induce false prophecies, people who tumble into each other's marriages after they're dead. Every inch of the earth has a graveyard, more pharmaceuticals, lives curated by drugs, the pills we swallow and the pills we reject, the way you never really know anybody. That's a quick trip through some of the images and ideas the writer Ben Marcus hits the reader with in Notes from the Fog, his latest collection of short stories. Reading them is like ingesting a powerful hallucinogen synthesized by a computer that's digested a good chunk of the internet. They feel the way life these days often feels, but with its skin peeled off. Welcome to Think Again, Ben.
Thank you so much.
It always feels a little weird characterizing somebody's writing right in front of them.
That was weird.
I'm curious what your immediate reaction to what you just heard. Like, what did I miss or what?
I thought that was pretty thorough. You picked up some nice ones of the whole world being a graveyard, because some of those little details are buried in the stories. So you did a great job. I think we can stop now.
Okay. All right.
You fully summarized the book. I think we're done.
Let's all go home. I love this about these stories. There are like a couple of things that sort of resurface through multiple stories, but not in any overt or obvious way. And like,
yeah,
one is the fog. There is this notion of the fog, which we can talk about. There is this thing of like these dubious amorphous pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
And then there is this thing of death, of like everywhere you walk, death being present.
I mean, those are the three primary subject matters for everyone, right?
Pharmaceuticals.
Fog.
Fog and death, yeah.
Yeah. That seems kind of universal.
Yeah. Let's talk about the fog. Notes from the fog.
Sure.
Like, what is the fog for you, or the fug?
Yeah, well, in the story Blueprints for St. Louis, there's a main character, she's an architect, and she's trying to design a memorial for a terrorist attack, and she's kind of agonizing over it because she realizes it will never be adequate given the people who have suffered in order to, you know, lead to this memorial. And I guess I got into the way she started to think in being unable to come up with any structure that would ever honor something catastrophic. She starts to think that there's something kind of just out of the range of vision that would reveal everything. Like if someone says, you know, if only our vision were slightly sharper, we'd see ghosts. And she attributes this to someone else. I don't know if anyone has ever really said that. But I guess to me, it's connected to this idea that we're on the verge of a deeper understanding, but that we're just shy of it, that we're in a state of confusion and we can operate, like we can function.
Right.
But that in some ways, we've decided that certain mysteries just like can't be chased anymore if we want to live our lives. Deeper religious mysteries, why we're here, what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to act, what happens next, what this all really is, and we know that vision is super subjective. And so there's some of these things that are such conundrums, but if you consciously operated with all of this in your head, you'd kind of go mad. And so she seems to think, she puts out this speculative theory of bird vision, that birds just see meshes of light, that objects aren't objects, that everything is light. And it's kind of like half true. Right. And yet it's like, to me, I guess, I know this is a long answer, but
please.
I think it connects to like a deeper longing to be able to see and know and feel more. Like we look out and we think we know everything we're looking at. And of course we do, but there's also just this possibility that nothing is as it seems. And so I guess the fog, to bring it back to that, is maybe just that thing that gets in our way. That thing that keeps us from some larger clarity, and maybe the clarity itself is a myth, right? Clarity is a construct. Insight is a construct. But what about our desire for it? How do we manage our desire for that?
There's a moment in one of the stories, somebody says that it's difficult living in the moment before a great invention. And this what you're saying now is reminiscent of this. And both of these are I don't want this to come out wrong, but these are both surprisingly optimistic ideas considering the way that I feel within a lot of your stories.
Yeah.
Like, I feel that the characters, I feel the oppression of the world around them. I feel the like web of bullshit, a poor schmo being experimented on for human growth lights, you know, because he can't, that's his job, you know?
Yeah, so do what your boss tells you
to
do.
This sort of dystopian hell that I think a lot of us do feel we're living in, but what you're also indicating or nudging towards in these things is
something will save
something
us.
Something better.
It's funny you see it that way, because like I guess I'm thinking of the way in which, at least for me, it's easy to believe that some little technological advancement might actually kind of materially change my life or make things better. Or the way in which I think there's a myth that we're living in a time of really rapid technological advancement.
Right.
I don't really know if history's going to see like new emojis in your iPhone as like a real advancement. I mean, I actually think it is a really significant advancement.
Well, I mean, I was thinking that like advancement and change are two different things.
Well,
I mean,
sure.
I don't think anyone could argue we're not in a time of rapid change.
Yes, that's right.
The question is whether progress.
And two, though, like maybe it's easy to believe that something will come along that, you know, spares us from death, for instance, or changes our our medical futures, right? We are allowed to indulge a kind of a low-grade, maybe quiet fantasy. I mean, I do. I think, man, maybe I won't have to die. I mean, probably in the way anyone does. It's just like, yeah, I'm going to be different. I'm going to figure that out.
Once on this show a long time ago, I talked to Carl Ove Nausgaard.
Yeah, sure.
And one of the surprise clips that came up at the end of the show was, I think, Michio Kaku talking about uploading your consciousness living forever. And Nausgaard was, I would say, predictably utterly horrified by that.
You know, there's a passage in one of my stories where a character's kind of thinking about how, like, when pain gets kind of resolved, we're going to look back and think about the way in which we manage pain as just idiotic, that there was this kind of code around the people who hid their pain the best, all the ways in which you're supposed to be stoic and sort of celebrated for not showing that it just fucking hurts. And he's just going to say, someone says, you know, we're just going to be seen as total mules, that we just literally endured this and it's going to sort of be embarrassing. Anyway, it's a speculative thought about the ways in which we've kind of wrapped our heads around our current predicament. And that if some of these things are alleviated, we're going to have different hindsight.
As I'm talking to you right now, as you know, I have slept poorly on my neck.
And
I can barely turn my head.
You're bleeding on the floor right now, which is awkward for me.
Yeah, exactly. The audience can't see it. Thank God this is audio. But do you have a paper towel by any chance?
You know, I'm all out. But listen, I want this pain to teach you, as you're saying.
Guys,
so I'm not going to help you.
Can we get a mop in here so at least we don't slip and make this worse?
Someone once said that, like, I had gone through a kind of a terrible, weird autoimmune thing, and I had this unspeakable pain, and I finally sort of realized that why people throw themselves out of buildings, like, in pain.
Mm,
and
it was that
and sometimes
bad,
when people say, yeah, you know, pain's really instructive, I just, my totally biased thought is, you really haven't been in, like, serious pain. Like, when you have the ability to say that and be sanguine like that, that's just, it's a total bias on my part, but I'm just like, well,
no.
You know, good luck. Maybe you'll go your whole life without.
I get that. And I certainly understand the horror and smugness of like saying that to, for example, somebody that's dying of cancer when you yourself have never been through anything like that.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's self-protective to say it too, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, you want to have an advanced strategy for this thing.
Yeah.
So you want to think that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, those things are positive and negative, like this sort of fear of what's coming next. And I think my characters do have this kind of tendency to speculate into like tomorrow or a year from now and to sort of, you know, wonder what might change about them. But it's, again, I hope connected to a kind of yearning, just to be other than they are.
Speaking of like being other than you are and kind of speculating your way out of your situation, there's a way in which your characters, or a lot of them anyway, are like not in their own lives. There's the boy in the first story in the book who, you know, we have the idea of kids on the, we have the reality of kids on the autistic spectrum don't, but he's not, that's not really what's going on with him. He just sort of seems, or we don't know. But
well, he's making a very conscious choice not to kind
love
of
parents.
Love his parents and everything else is the same. And yeah, to me, it's almost just a slightly precocious adult choice that sometimes we do without even making it. I mean, I think teenagers can kind of shut off a little bit or all of their sympathy and empathy, if they have any, towards their parents. And so, yeah, to me, that story was maybe slightly accelerating that a little bit and seeing what happened.
Well, and so then the father, who still has fatherly impulses toward the child, is in a sense not in his own life properly, because he can't connect with the child. He can't connect with the wife. The wife keeps her feelings to herself.
Yeah.
She's sort of sympathizing. I mean, she's seeing what's happening with the child, but she's also on his side. And so in this way, there's it's just all these people kind of unable to
The fabulous estrangement of family. Yeah, and I'm really late to that party. That's that's been a great subject of fiction kind of from the beginning, right? The special agony of a family, which isn't to say there isn't a special joy in a family.
Sure.
You know, the way in which I think we can misbehave the most around the people who possibly won't throw us out.
There's a great line in that story. What is the story called
again? Cold Little Bird.
Yeah, Cold Little Bird. Someone is calling out the father for his quote-unquote dangerous feelings, I think.
Yeah.
And the father says,
all
of the parents'
are dangerous.
Feelings are dangerous.
You know, you're married to someone and you're in love with that person, you have a kid, and then you're kind of co-managers of this project. And that's sort of not necessarily connected to your love relationship. It's just a different, it's a different part of your brain, and you're, you know, you're not doing it alone where you make all the decisions. You're doing it in tandem, and it's really natural to disagree. And then if you're disagreeing when the stakes are really high, I don't know. To me, I guess it was just a way to have a different layer of conflict that wasn't just a conflict of, like, why doesn't my son love me anymore?
Right.
And I thought, like, that couldn't hold the whole spotlight, or it would kind of crumble a little bit.
That it had to be between the parents as well.
Local conflict kind of helping to tow along the larger conflict, and it's all kind of mechanistic in a way, but...
No, that's interesting. I mean, Do you think that way when you're planning a story?
No, but when I show up for an interview, it's sort of like, that's what I did. No, but, you know, it's funny. You know, you get asked how you do these things.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And it's just an interesting set of questions, because I think for the most part, no one has any idea. And then some people really just try to play ball a little bit and try to say.
Sure.
But it's not, I don't know. It's not like you're sitting there with like a whiteboard and a bunch of, I don't know, modules, and you're shifting them around. I mean, it is a very, I think, it's an intuitive process, and you just hope your intuition isn't totally fucked. And then after the fact, you can say, oh, look, like, it looks like there's a subplot. And maybe sometimes in revision, when something's really wrong, or just if something doesn't feel alive at all, you can say, well, why is this dead? What's missing? And then you can go back and try to impose more things.
So I'm thinking three things at once, but one is like, I remember reading Zadie Smith once talking about how, saying that there are two kinds of writers.
Yeah.
And I would say, like, she's brilliant, but beware when anybody ever says there are two kinds of anything. But she says there are two kinds of writers, and one kind maps out their whole destination. And I think when I talked to Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish writer, he said he does that. Like, he maps everything out.
Yeah, I've heard that
out.
Too, about
and
him.
Then, but then the other kind, which she said she is, and it sounds like you are.
You grope along.
Navigating through the fog and finding their way.
Yeah, and you know, I think in the end, and there are probably those two, and there are probably other kinds as well, but I think that does, that kind of covers those broad bases. And, you know, I teach, and so I also see that in students when they come and they say, you know, I want to write a story, and they literally recite the whole story to me, and I just think, well, why bother? You know, like, the whole point would be to figure that out. But on the other hand, then I think, well, you know, what do I know?
Who am I to say?
Well, the point is the result. So I think, like, in the same way when people are like, do you drink coffee when you write? And what kind of chair do you use? And what kind of, do you go on the internet? Do you not? Like, all of that stuff. It's interesting in a local way, but it's irrelevant connected to the product or the thing that gets done. Like, so, you know, in the end, it really kind of doesn't matter. You do the thing you think you need to do.
You wouldn't be doing it if the immersion in that process weren't something that does it for you in some
profound
way.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully way. If like, it's not, you know, like, it evolves and you you slowly figure some stuff out that might help. And maybe there are times when you say, you know, it's not working to be so intuitive. I'm going to try planning this out because maybe, you know, you need to be adaptable. Or, you know, I get bored. Right. I get bored too. I'm just like, I've written this story before. I'll start a new story and think, shit, I've written this already. So what do I do to not? And sometimes you have to kind of pull a Hail Mary and do something a little off your, you know, normal map.
Yeah, those are, I guess, those kinds of questions when you're sort of looking at your work and your career from this bird's eye view, which is like probably both annoying and unhelpful and at other times helpful to jar you into something.
Yeah, well, I think for me anyway, it's too easy to be reminded that I've kind of covered something already. And I just don't have an endless imagination or even an endless set of interests. And I just think, I sure would love to do another story where someone's experimented on medically, but
I
haven't done 3 or 4 of them. Right? And you're just like, shit, like maybe I change my name and just kind of want to keep this going.
You're like, I want to write it, but does anyone want to read that again?
Yeah, and so it can feel a little conspicuous. You're just like, why, you know, can't I get rid of this idea and then make room for something else?
It's those moments when I guess the artist can relate to like Brian Eno and John Cale's oblique strategies cards,
or exactly
putting a pin through the Bible and seeing what word you find.
Then you get away from your intention and all of that. And I have a friend who's a painter. I've talked about this a little bit before, but I'm 51. He's probably about the same age. A couple of years ago, we were talking. He was just like, yeah, fuck, you know, I've kind of just done everything I kind of want to do, but I want to keep working. Like, I like to work. And he said what he was doing was he was going back to everything he had been dismissive of in his 20s, say, when he was maybe more guarded, a little more insecure. And he's like, fuck figurative painting, fuck all these things. And now he's like, you know, now I'm just not sure what I had against all that stuff. So I'm just going to do it and see what it's like if I do it. And I've done a lot of that as a writer where I'm like, okay, I'm just tired of this territory. I'm going to do something. Well, like that story, Blueprints of St. Louis, for instance.
Right.
I had always sort of semi-consciously forsworn against really writing about an artist and an artist's process, looking inside the agonies of an artist trying to make something. I just thought that was a big fucking snooze. I didn't want to read it. I thought it was, you know, just too self-centered, too meta, insider baseball. And then there was just a day when I was like, I don't have anything else. So I'm just going to do that. Like, why do I hate that? Why was I against it? Well, I couldn't even connect to the feelings of that anymore. So I just thought, this is a way to at least try to write another story.
That's a really interesting story too, because it ends up being in part about how we all deal with the kind of psychic burden and reality of these tragedies that keep happening, school shootings. Where do you put that in your head? How do you actually, you know, and how do you deal with the guilt around not feeling what you're supposed to feel when you're supposed to feel it if you don't?
That's exactly right. Like she has a line where she said she knows she's on, you know, grieving for these people, but can't figure out why she's not collapsed on the floor and capable of living because of it. Right. She would think like, this is so atrocious. Like, how can I even function?
I'm talking next week to, I don't know why I'm like name dropping throughout this whole episode.
It's kind of unpleasant.
It's really annoying. but I'm talking next week to an anonymous photographer who shoots like in war zones and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And one of the things that's freaking me out as I prepare for that interview is the feeling that the reason this kind of photography exists is to kind of thrust us into the middle of this scene, pull us out of our kind of everyday Amazon.com lives and make us feel it.
Build empathy.
But like when I look at a photograph, oftentimes I don't have that access. Mm. Like even if it's a really good photograph, in part because of maybe I'm a bad person, or maybe it's just the overwhelm of everything.
It's a really good question. Or we're accustomed to photographs of atrocity and they're still at a remove, right? There's a way we don't feel necessarily implicated by them, or we're saturated by them.
And so then this question of, is there a moral imperative? Should we, if we were good people, should we be rushing off somewhere else right now, you know?
Well, it's sort of connected to to the ways in which climate activists are talking about not just the political inertia, which is based on greed, you know, and just absolute malice and cruelty, but the kind of the inertia of someone who is even sympathetic to the cause, that there's this theory now that it's such a consummate problem, and we're told that it's irreversible, and that the problem is so large, people have almost just shut down in response to it.
Right.
So it can't even really be in the news cycle to any degree. I mean, this thing that came out a week ago about how, yeah, you know what?
Actually, we've only got, 15 years.
This
or
it's happening tonight, you guys.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so, and of course, there's lots of reasons why things don't make it into the news cycle. But I was just listening to some people talk pretty interestingly about how the problem is so consummate and so intense that there seems to be this individual inability to deal. And also just a feeling of hopelessness, a feeling that nothing now matters. And so they're trying to rethink the framing of the crisis. You know, it's sort of funny though. It's like, well, you know what? So your body's on fire,
right?
And you're gonna die. And that they're like, shit, that didn't really worry them. We've got to reframe this. It's a language problem. If only we were stating this differently, everyone would suddenly care, but.
Yeah, and I think the truth is that, like, you know, for all the op-ed pieces and all of this hand-wringing about, like, why aren't we caring more? Like, if you look at almost any given individual, they are somewhere on that spectrum,
yes,
of being kind of in the fog with respect to these.
Yeah,
or
certainly trying to do things. And so it's not like a finger-pointing thing so much as a larger phenomenon of paralysis, even among the good-willed. And that, but you know, we could say that happens with a lot of crises, right? Not just climate change.
I had the idea this morning about a WPA style federal program. Like, if, for example, in a freak election, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gets elected president, hiring one person per family to kind of follow you around and, like, ethically advise you on what to recycle, which fish not to eat, where not to go on vacation because it's exploitative.
It's funny that that has to be such an extreme fantasy because it also could be read as just common sense.
Right.
Not that the person has to stalk you. I mean, we could get that information in, like, safer, less creepy ways.
I guess what I mean is that like, you're making a million micro decisions every second, and you often don't have.
Yeah.
We've had the sense that there are these connecting webs of information that we don't fully have access to.
Yeah, and I think too, we're talking about the ways in which people kind of shut down.
Yeah.
Around a crisis that's so big that it's unmanageable because they have the local crisis of their lives and their jobs and their relationships. And
there's that.
I'm
curious what things people tend to pick up on and ask you about in your work and, like, what they miss.
What's important to me, I suppose, is something that's hopefully very intense emotionally and very kind of grounded in emotional realism. And so I think the stories are, to various degrees, adorned with the fantastical or the invented. And some of it looks like it could happen very soon. Some of it maybe is further off. And I wrestle with not somehow pitching a story into a place where it loses its matterfulness emotionally, where it might be, oh, well, that's
where it's so kind of... what's the word? Conceptual or something that...
I think that I feel I used to kind of get read as someone who was... Well, with my first book, The Age of Wire and String, it seemed like the word, small as it was, because it really wasn't widely reviewed, was, well, there's some kind of interesting conceptual conceits here, but this is a cold, bloodless book that doesn't really tell us anything about what it feels to be alive.
I
thought... That was part of my value system. And so it was jarring to kind of connect to that and maybe good in that it kind of pushed me to, you know, be sure I kind of try to strategize as supply as I can about that, because that's just in a way more important to me than, oh, you've invented a new kind of pill or like all of it's like the furniture of a story that's kind of meant to push characters into slightly more extreme places that can then, you know, lead to some emotional territory that's kind of harder to get at in our daily lives. And so I haven't really read too many reviews this time around. The basic book review doesn't quite do that even. It sort of summarizes a little bit and says, these stories are like Black Mirror. And and then they say, but you know, they're really bleak and you shouldn't read a lot at once or you'll get depressed. And I think that's either like a great selling point for a certain kind of reader or a total turnoff for another kind of reader.
Right.
You know, and that's another big conversation is why so bleak? Why so dark? Why so negative? Like, I like reading things that put what feels like the real world emotionally in front of me instead of reading that feels like more escapist, like a chance to be entertained, but not think about kind of mortal things. And I know the value of that reading too.
The kind of dread that you do get at is something that, like, as we've been talking about, everybody feels, everyone is surrounded by, both in their personal lives and in the broader
context. I think a lot of people have no interest in that in their reading. Or they don't think of reading as a gateway to that. They're like, fuck that. Why would I read something so bleak?
Like, when somebody dies in your life, and there are a couple of situations here, I mean, a number of stories in which somebody passes away, it throws everything into sharp relief and it throws your emotional life bare in a way that you maybe don't have access to, even if you're living with a kind of like low-grade ambient dread the rest of the time. And having those elements in the story, I think, does that to both the characters and the readers.
You know, there are these really varied motives for reading. Like, what is reading and why do we even do it? And I guess I have always felt, in a way, comforted by some of the bleakest stuff. I think of the Austrian writer Thomas Bernhard, who's really kind of relentlessly grim but also funny. And I feel a comfort because I feel like he's not really looking away from the world and pretending it's other than it is. And I am saying that while hoping not to criticize that looking away and that pretending, because I actually think it's really valuable. And I pursue a lot of entertainment that does just that. I mean, there's kinds of TV.
Escapism.
Yeah, there's TV I watch that I really need to just not be thinking about dire things.
What is your go-to most escapist fun show of all times, out of curiosity?
Oh, geez.
Or recent times?
I watched a really curious show that I thought was going to be really junky, and I've literally talked to nobody about this. It's called Castaways, and it looked like a reality show. It is a reality show, but at the end, I was telling my wife Heidi this. I was like, because she was out of town, I watched it on my own, and I was like, you know, it's not a reality show; it's a documentary. Anyway, just briefly,
people are on an island.
12 people are kind of shipwrecked in various ways. It's a series of islands, so they're all separate, and they each wash up with someone else's luggage. But there's no prize. There's nothing.
Okay.
There's really, the goal is really, can they survive? And there's two ways of getting off the island. They can say, I quit, or they can wait for rescue.
Okay.
And essentially, they all just kind of collapse and break down. And some try to find other people. Others are like into their solitude. And it just has this almost like really slow, like Frederick Wiseman documentary pacing, where I'm just like, this is really, it's just odd, because it's so kind of defiantly non-dramatic. I don't know how much I should proselytize about this show, but it was very interesting to me because it did not fit a genre. It wasn't like Survivor, which I also watch, where, you know, there's a contest and they're going for money and there's conspiracy and you're trying to kind of leverage and keep secrets against people. It literally just, there was no guile. I mean,
it sounds very existential.
It was really that way. So there's these two dudes, kind of like bro guys, who they find each other and they're fairly good at survival shit.
Okay.
So they get a little bit of food and they kind of, they're like, we can do this. Like, we might get bored, but we're going to live. We don't have to quit. And then someone else just suddenly like paddles around the island exhausted and starving. And they're like, fuck, we got to carry this guy. He's not going to bring anything to the table. Are we going to share our food? So like all these ethical things come up. And I don't know, I was like really into it. I just, it was at the end
like,
of the day.
Our libertarian bro lifestyle will no longer suffice.
Well, and so like, they actually kind of shun this guy at first. And then they kind of get a conscience and they get actually almost crippled with guilt about it. And so one of the dudes who shuns the guy, you learn in his backstory that he has this kind of ne'er-do-well drug addict brother who he's tired of giving handouts to. And it's all just like, oh, that was like a neat – little pairing and
kind of deep and problematizes
and then
the stereotype.
He's just like, you know, I just don't like people who can't help themselves. And suddenly all these people's worldviews are coming out. And of course, at the end, they're all totally broken down and they're all kind of five of them kind of make it and they find each other. And they're all sort of like in love with each other in a way. And, if you know, it's all going to go away and they're all just going to return to being whatever the fuck they were before. But I don't know. There was just this way I thought, oh, this is like not really a reality show, but I guess it was. It was just a reality show without a lot of the affectations.
Well, yeah, because reality shows haven't really been reality shows. They've mostly been
they
social
were pretty,
engineering
pretty constructed
experiments.
Anyway, so I didn't mean to go off on such a tear about that.
I'm so glad that you did.
And I've literally
awesome.
Talked to no one else who's watched it, so like I don't really know. If someone might be like, oh, dude, you don't even know. That show is totally rigged. And so like I haven't looked it up.
You know, I mean, your perspective is valid, even if it turns out to be totally rigged.
Just looked like it wasn't trying. And so I was really interested in that. It seemed very patient with itself.
Briefly, I mean, going back to what you were saying before about the tension between the, like, totally far out and surreal mm-hmm. and the very emotionally real and grounded. I mean, I feel that for sure in your stories. And in that sense, you probably get this all the time. The only other writer that makes me feel that way is George Saunders.
Yeah.
I was going to say that, but then I also recently read Lauren Groff's Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And there's something of that tension there, too. I mean, I don't know how helpful it is to tell a writer. Whoa. It's not that you're sounding in any way.
No, I get it. No, it's flattering. I think, you know, I'm reading Florida now. I'm almost done with it. And she's fantastic. And she just has, she also has such range. And she can write really, really well and really gravely within the here and now, too.
Sure.
So, you know, I really always read everything she does and really admire it. And then, of course, George Saunders really, I think, has kind of, in a lot of ways, set the terms for a lot of contemporary fiction. And the way I see it is there was this sort of period of fiction where there were very clearly these two camps. And it was like the realists and the experimentalists or the postmodernists or whatever you wanted to call them. All those words are a little weird now.
Sure.
But they were the ones who were maybe reacting against the kind of what they saw as a safer domestic narrative that had kind of been told to death. And so they were just like, let's push on physics. Let's push on reality a little bit. Let's play with form. And Bartholomew and Coover
and
Gass and Angela Carter and
a lot
of people you can name. And I do want to say those divisions in some sense are hollow. And like if you talked at length, you'd find there were so many exceptions. So I don't want to come across as if I kind of subscribe to them. But it was sort of just what I heard growing up, like that, you know, and there was an anthology called like The Anti-Story, as if like story itself was this sort of enemy. But it was, and then there was an anthology I loved edited by Tobias Wolff called, it's The Vintage Book of New American Short Stories or something like that. And in his intro, he sort of is, in a way, having an argument against the writers he sees as like, more postmodern, kind of against this emotional realism, against realism. And I think nowadays those arguments really are gone and there's been a lot of synthesis of these territories.
Yeah.
And someone like George is a really good example because it was as if, I don't think he did this literally, it was as if he said, why can't I have it all? Like what, I am interested in everything, the human experience being at the core of it, but I can strategize any way I would like to deliver that. And some of those ways might be fantastical, hyperbolic, exaggerated, but that didn't undercut the emotional possibility of the story.
Pure formalism is always unsatisfying in some sense. Doing something just to not do something else.
In hindsight, it does look super limited, and yet probably in the moment, there must have been some vitality behind some of these attempts, right?
Sure, that's right. It also takes some of its maybe emotional force from its historical meaning in the moment, just like punk rock just by its being punk rock.
Something novel comes along and I could imagine for a certain reader it was really delightful to encounter this, what felt like a kind of antidote towards an otherwise kind of maybe dull territory, at least to that reader. So some barriers have come down, but it's possible that some younger reader is going to come along and see something really fucked and dead about that and is going to correct in a new, interesting way.
Yeah,
and that's just how it works.
It's sort of tempting and I think boring ultimately, but probably true to say that this has something to do with the internet and the way everything overlaps there, past, present,
I'm sure.
Real, surreal, fiction, non.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure
I'm
you're
sort
right.
of tired of saying that.
Yeah, you know? I think it should just be a given for any conversation. Yeah. It's like, yeah, the internet caused this.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, this is the perfect moment, I think, for us to move into the, for the audience, these are surprise video interview clips from Big Think's archives of video interviews, each one on a, like, idea, and they'll be thought starters for us. I haven't seen them, Ben hasn't seen them, we are encountering them fresh with you, the audience. This is Dixon Despommiers. Oh, he's a microbiologist and ecologist by training, and it is called The Challenges of Vertical Farming.
As of this moment, the WHO and the Population Council estimate that about 50% of us live in cities. And the other half, of course, live somewhere else. The other thing we can learn from NASA, of all places, is how much land those 7 billion people, half urban, half rural, actually need to produce their food every year. And it turns out to be the size of South America. So the size of South America in landmass is used just to grow our crops that we plant and harvest. I'm not talking about the herbivores like the cows and the goats and the sheep. So when you think about how much food is consumed by cities, let's say half, it takes half of the size of South America just to produce it. Now, if the human population continues to increase, which we expect it will. So over the next 40 years, you might have 3 billion more people to feed. And you look around for the land where that's going to come from in terms of traditional farms, and you don't find it. It isn't there. So the biggest problem facing us as a global species is where will the food for the next 3 billion people come from? So it could come from some place other than a traditional farm. And the question is, could vertical farming solve that problem? So by vertical farming and a vertical farm, I mean any building that grows food inside of it, or in which you grow food, which is taller than a single story. So there are many examples of vertical farms out there which are not traditionally thought of as towering gardens of Eden, so to speak, as the images on Google might suggest, from some of the planners and designers that have submitted their own visions of what they think a vertical farm should look like. Most of those would satisfy the cover of any science fiction magazine I could think of and attract a lot of attention and get people to ask, well, what is that building and what is it doing? But we're not pretty close to seeing those yet. I think those are going to be expensive and they're going to take a lot of rethinking with regards to urban planning. But we don't have to do that in order to have vertical farms already. There's a vertical farm in Singapore. It's a brand new building. It looks like a greenhouse from the outside, but it's 4 stories tall. But it's a clever design. It uses traditional growing systems, though. It uses soil-based potted plants on a series of conveyor belts, which migrates the plants by gravity, some kind of a grandfather clock-like apparatus, which actually moves this conveyor belt of plants near the windows maybe once or twice an hour so that every plant gets the same amount of sunlight during the day at least. Because it rains every day, there's certainly no shortage of water for these plants either, and he uses traditional fertilizer. And the guy has moved from a 2,000 square foot operation to a 20,000 square foot operation, the same.
It almost makes you wish we could just eat from UV light.
Grow lamps, yeah,
right?
Yeah. Or you had those. There's also, what was that thing called, Jug?
Oh yeah.
In that same story, right? It's sort of like
a spoof on Soylent. Yeah.
But of course, the ingredients of those meal in a jugs have to be farmed.
They have to be farmed
somewhere.
You know, listening to that does sort of make me think that, you know, is there just a sentimental attachment to farming itself, and that vertical farming, how much is that really solving? And what we're really talking about is nourishing the human
body.
What
about lab-grown meat? What about, you mean, right?
Well, like, and you know, as I was kind of making fun of some of those new tech ideas in the Grow Light Blues, well, I remember reading this thing that Elon Musk said a couple years ago, and he was just talking, it was something like, how to be as productive as Elon Musk. I was like, I'm going to read that. it just made me angry.
Did it help? No,
Yeah, I mean, after that, shit just took off for me. No, but he talked about like his time management and his day, and he talked about meals as pain points.
Oh my God.
And he was just like, you know, a meal is a pain point because I'm not working. And so what he's doing is he's overlooking what a meal also is, which is this spontaneous chance to kind of connect with people or to read a cereal box or whatever the fuck.
Right.
But like, it's funny. So I have two kids and we're always struggling to actually have a family meal, which I don't know. It's just really hard.
How old are your kids?
They're 9 and 14.
Okay.
And when we do it, we're like, well, that was actually really fun. And even they like it. So there's just stuff that happens at a meal that isn't about eating.
Right.
However, you know, when you think of it in these kind of ecological crisis terms, it does sort of seem like that's going to be a casualty, whatever emotional shit we're going to get from eating. If we're smart, it's probably going to be a casualty to just figuring out like the pill or the fabricated nutrition that's going to keep us alive.
Humans are so funny. Like, I mean, the way that we solve problems and then we have to like solve the problem we created by solving the problem. And
well,
so
that's exactly right.
Like
yeah.
if we eliminate meals, I mean, it's happening even now in a sense, but where we're like, okay, so we eliminated this time that psychologists say was essential
crucial.
To connect to each other and have new ideas.
Yeah.
So how can we engineer that time into our lives now?
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in the same way that, you know, the new iPhone update has a way to, you know, monitor your screen time and use it less. It's just like, well, you guys caused that.
Yeah.
Now you're selling the solution. I mean, vertical farming sounds fantastic, but it also seems to presume a kind of, well, it presumes a government that's even going to acknowledge the problem.
Right.
And I don't know what our current government, I can't think of the name of the president right now, but I just can't imagine there's an especially sympathetic attitude about, you know, any kind of future forecasting of this kind, right?
No.
I mean, this
well,
is a
I
version.
Don't, I don't think this works for the right or the left, right? Because the extreme left is suspicious of techno-biological / entrepreneurial-driven solutions.
They want their bespoke food trucks, too. They're just like, does this mean my food truck goes away?
No, I think this supposes some kind of moderate future that is hard to imagine from
but
our current
vantage. I think it's also, it's really important that people are doing this work and kind of presenting these options. But it seems connected a little to the climate change conversation we were having where, clearly, like, I guess I know abstractly that we're going to run out of food. And, you know, part of me is like, maybe that'll be good, you know, and I lose some weight. Terrible, you know, dumb, superficial reaction. But, like, it's hard to really internalize that crisis.
It occurred to me listening to him that, I mean, I went back to the Zadie Smith, there are two kinds of people thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, there are the kinds of people who try to solve these kinds of problems. And probably most of them are motivated by, I thought of that Paul Simon line that's like, this is a lonely life, sorrows everywhere you turn. But that is worth something if you think about it. That is worth some money. That's worth something if you, you know, I was thinking
that
you know,
switch.
Like that solution orientation seems to be pretty connected for many, many people with the capitalist impulse.
But like we're talking about our ability to kind of actively sustain concern about something that's offstage.
Right.
Right. And so remember after Hurricane Sandy here in New York, for a little while, there was a pretty interesting time in some newspapers where there were these proposals about how to protect the whole kind of New York Harbor, right?
Right,
like,
right,
why
right.
did the tunnel flood and all of that? And, you know, we know this whole place is fucked and doomed. But but then all these kind of really imaginative and maybe semi-possible plans started to come out. Some were really kind of like deeply organic with like certain kind of plantings out into the harbor adjust the current. There were some really kind of like granular organic plans and then some that were much more imposing and much more more kind of material.
But lots of smart solutions.
Yeah, but I don't know. That whole phase just kind of went away, as far as I know. I mean, is anything being done?
Yeah.
Like a single thing?
I guess I don't know. I'm not the guy who would know. However, I wouldn't be surprised if that momentum kind of like.
Well, it felt like we got engaged in a kind of problem solving because there was something sort of immediate, and that hurricane really did hammer the city in really immediate ways. Then it ended.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, it seems like, again, we're talking about some limitation to entertain a fear if it's not like knocking on the door.
You know, this idea that somehow like the profit motive is the only thing that can incentivize humans to do anything.
Yeah.
It's sort of true in one sense, but it also incentivizes people to do all kinds of shit that we don't need. And
it's true and not true, especially with climate stuff, in that there is some speculative capitalism around wind energy and things like that
right.
now. But there are now, I mean, the deregulation of our era is, it's so insane now. It's tilted and now people realize there's money in acknowledging climate change.
But only people that don't already run a multi-billion dollar multinational gas company.
Got its tethers in the past. Yeah, that's right. And so those things cancel each other out.
It's hard to know where exactly we end up on the balance sheet. But
it seems like this larger question is like, how do we continually ignore like really good knowledge, really good information? We can listen to this very smart man and, you know, a few hours later, I'm going to have moved on from vertical farming.
Right.
And it's possible someone's listening and saying, well, you know, fuck you. I am doing X, Y, and Z. And, you know, just because you're saying you can't sustain this fear actively in your conscious mind doesn't mean people can't. And that's
sure.
defeatist. And so I think that that's true. And in that sense, you know, listening to him, well, you know, I imagine I'm going to bring up vertical farming to a friend today or, you know, and it's possible
right.
then that this slow, iterative, you know, spread of ideas is just a component of all of this.
Sure,
right?
Sure. No, that's right. I mean, and there are of course people that are doing brave, bold, and
they're
definitive,
better
and
people,
good things.
There's
yeah, better people than you and I. Okay. Well, now let's go on to something totally different. This one is from Leslie on our video team, and I had sent her my hallucinogenic opening spiel to
yeah.
this show.
Yeah.
And she said, for some reason, my mind jumped immediately to this clip when reading this description, not sure why.
Great.
So
let's do this.
This is Ben Goertzel. He's got a big artificial general intelligence kind of like wiki project where people are working on that. I know that because he was on this show and suggested that we trip on acid and discuss pan consciousness or like where everything is conscious, including rocks.
Okay.
He thought we should do that.
And did you do that?
That wasn't within the purview of this show, and I think he went back to Korea, but maybe someday, I hope.
Yeah.
My cousin, who lives in Hong Kong, is a game programmer, and he loves what I'm doing, but he just tells me when we discuss it, I need immediate gratification. Like, he codes something, and he sees a game character do something cool, right? And if you need that, if you really need to see something cool happen every day, AGI is not for you. In AGI, you may work 6 months and nothing interesting happens. And then something really, really interesting happens. So I think if someone doesn't have that kind of stubborn, pig-headed persistence, I will tend to implore them doing, for example, data analysis. Because that gives immediate gratification. You get a data set from a customer, you run a machine learning algorithm on it, and you get a result, which is interesting. The customer's happy. Then you go on to the next data set. And if you explain the different types of work available, actually most people are pretty good at choosing what won't drive them crazy. So some people are like, yeah, I want to do stuff that seems cool every day. And other people are like, well, I really want to understand, you know, how thinking works. I want to understand how cognition and vision work together. And that's much more interesting to me than applying an existing vision algorithm to solve someone's problem. So I tend to throw the issue at the potential employee or volunteer themselves, and sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't, but I trust them to know themselves better than I know them anyway. There are many different types and levels of problems that one encounters in doing AI work. And there are sort of low-level algorithmic problems or software design problems, which are solved via clever tricks. And then there are deeper problems, like how do you architect a perception system? How should perception and cognition work together in an AI system? If a system knows one language, how do you leverage that knowledge to help it learn another language? I find personally with these deeper problems, this is the kind of thing you solve while you're like walking the dog in the forest or taking a shower or driving down the highway or something. And seems to me that the people who make headway on these deeper problems have the personality type that carries the problem in their head all the time. Like, you'll think about this thing when you go to sleep, you're still thinking about it when you woke up, and you just keep chewing on this issue 100 times a day. It could be for days or weeks or years or even decades, and then the solution pops up for you. And not everyone has the inclination or personality to be obsessive at sort of keeping a problem like an egg in your mind, in your focus, until the solution hatches out. But that's a particular cognitive style or habit or skill which I see in everyone I know who's really making headway on the AGI problem.
I think one of the things that interests me the most about that field is not necessarily what it's trying to do, but what it's overlooking in doing it. And that this idea that, like, you know, we're going to kind of achieve artificial intelligence when there's so much non-artificial intelligence that's kind of getting overlooked.
Right.
In other words, we have all of these intelligent organisms and all of these humans whose own intelligence is being vastly underused. And if the idea is like we need to marshal intelligent agents or whatever you want to call them into doing things, it just seems as if we're sort of saying, well, human intelligence is kind of now off the table.
Right.
Let's reinvent this thing. But, you know, it already got invented, and we're sort of chasing after this thing that already exists. And so it's odd, right? And of course, it's very hard to do. And I guess we're supposed to believe in the dramatic arc of their struggle to do it. And I don't mean to undervalue just the research of this, because it's clearly fascinating. And, you know, we could be interested in cloning without saying we need more people.
Right.
So, you know, I get that. You want an organ farm or whatever. But it's harder to connect to kind of a sort of a more humanistic awareness in some of this. That was a short clip.
Very short clip. I mean, I think cars probably can and will drive a hell of a lot better than human beings,
yeah.
You know, because we're all over the place.
Yeah.
I don't know when artificial general intelligence will do something that we're not already able to do. But I mean, it's funny, like, we don't understand our own intelligence, and that's sort of their project in a weird way. It's a different angle on psychology. Like, let's see, how do we make creativity? And like, if we try this, what does it feel like, creativity?
Yeah.
Is this poem good?
Right, but some of the people doing this don't actually value poems and creativity in real life.
Some
and
of them don't.
Yeah.
But no, that's right. And
Or they're doing it for a world that doesn't.
Sure.
Like, you've got a lot of actual poets, I guess. And like, do we need to create fake poems? Because you're already ignoring the real poems. You're going to ignore the fake ones too?
Right, right. Let's put a little bit of the money and energy and whatever behind. And publicizing,
you already voted
what's out
against
there.
Funding actual poetry. But on the other hand, look, I get the value of this, and I definitely think it's interesting. And I also really, you know, for the record, really believe in research that is not articulating a practical application.
Right.
I think that that is important. My dad's an abstract mathematician, and you know, and at dinner parties, you know, someone's like, "Well, what's your math for?" And there's not really an answer, but there. I also don't think there has to be. On the other hand, the ethics of AI, I think, are huge, and it'd be one thing if we lived under a different kind of government where let's say a different sort of economic system where we haven't seen over and over again the exploitation of tech to take away privacy and just to feed people's baser urges while destroying their lives. You know, and I know probably there are good ethical conversations around this stuff. The question is, will those conversations really have any leverage or bearing?
That's what it is. Because I know he's involved in some of this too. And it's like, how do we, you know, make empathetic AI and so on? But you're creating a technology that will give unimaginable power to some people.
Yeah, and someone's going to try to own it and will own it.
And
does that mean they shouldn't do it? You know, we know historically it doesn't really work to shut down knowledge pursuits, right? And I'm not going to sign on for that. Wait, so he's the guy who wanted to trip on acid with you.
And discuss what is it called? Panpsychism.
Okay.
Because, well, we got to the end of the conversation and I was trying to get him to explain panpsychism. He literally believes that everything in the universe has consciousness.
Yeah. Okay.
And I was like, I have no idea what that means.
Right,
you know,
Everything
vibrates with energy for sure.
Yeah.
Are we talking about energy? If we have 12 hours and we tripped on acid, we could talk about it. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what that means. I mean, I can't behave with the same sort of reverence toward a camera as I can toward a human. There are different levels of complexity.
It's just hard to divorce all of this from just like the state of affairs of actual people too, whose minds are being undervalued and underused.
Yeah.
And that's sort of it's an economic question in a sense that it's not like we have a society that prizes intelligence exactly.
Right.
And so, I don't know. I'm curious.
No,
like,
that's the tricky thing. And that's where the ethics get murky. It's like, I agree with you. I would never shut down any kind of research. But if you're creating something that potentially disintermediates millions upon millions of people from future jobs when we already have millions of people starving around the world.
With no jobs.
It just seems irresponsible if that's not somehow part of a larger project to address those questions.
So it seems like the underlying question is like, what do we want from technology? Like, what is it we really would like?
Yeah.
Or what is it we really need?
Right. And the problem is the we, because like there is no we. Like there isn't a we.
Yeah,
like,
no, there really is not a we. The we died last week. Yeah. But even if like I think, well, what do I really want? Like what would I, if I could just kind of dream up what would come along, what would I want? And yeah, it wouldn't be AI exactly, you know?
Mm.
I'd like pain relief, that kind of thing.
Well, I think we've basically pretty much solved the problems.
We did it.
It's good now.
I feel so much better.
Cool. So no more need for this show or for writing any more stories.
Yeah, signing off.
What are we going to do now?
I don't know. Get a smoothie?
I think a smoothie would be good. Ben Marcus, I really enjoyed talking to you, man.
Likewise.
You for being on the show.
Thanks. It was really fun.
Cool. Well, I think we can all agree that that's enough thinking for one day. Go forth and do. Do something good for yourself and for someone else. And if you love this show and you want to see it live forever, please take a minute to rate or review us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Feel free to join the conversation on our Facebook group, Friends of Think Again, a Big Think podcast. And we'll be back next week with the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, Lindsay Addario. See you then.